Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service, with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Jonathan Savage, and at 14 hours GMT on Wednesday the 12th of February, these are our main stories. Formula One has called off April's Chinese Grand Prix. We'll have the latest on the impact of the coronavirus on world sport. The decision has come as the WHO seeks answers to the crisis.
We have to expect the best but be prepared for the worst. We don't know. It might have already spread to many countries, and so this may become a global outbreak or even a pandemic.
And Pope Francis has ruled that allowing married priests isn't the way to solve a shortage in the Amazon. Also in this podcast, high above the earth, two superpowers are engaged in a Cold War-style spy drama involving satellites. And
this victory here is the beginning of the end for Donald Trump.
Can any Democrat catch Bernie Sanders after his victory in New Hampshire? The world needs a plan. The World Health Organization is determined to come up with one. This is the second day of a two-day summit with the goal of meeting the threat of the newly named COVID-19 virus head-on. Jane Ellison is an executive director at the WHO. She said the priority is to limit the global spread of the virus.
The vast majority of cases are in China. As far as cases around the rest of the world go, the focus is on containment and the focus is on preparedness and getting ready to respond. And, you know, our big message is, you know, the more people put time and investment into preparing and being able to respond, the more likely it is that we can contain this outbreak and that countries can keep their people safe.
A couple of hours before we came into the studio, it was announced that motor racing officials had called off the upcoming Chinese Grand Prix as a result of the outbreak. I found out more from our sports news reporter, Alex Capstick.
Yeah, it's only happened once before. That was in 2011 when the Bahrain Grand Prix was cancelled because of the Arab uprising. At that time, they tried to get it back on, but they didn't in the end. It was actually wiped out for that year. This was expected. The Chinese sports authority or Chinese authorities have said that they should cancel all sporting events in the city. That was a few weeks ago. And then the organisers of the Grand Prix confirmed today that it would be cancelled, and Formula One authorities have gone along with that. Of course, they have to. It's a big logistical exercise, as you can imagine, organising a Grand Prix. So they had to come up with this decision very quickly because it takes weeks, months to get to all the cars, all the equipment over to those cities. It's a big operation, so they've had to do this now.
How else is sport being affected? Because we know there's an Olympics in Japan, there's another Formula One Grand Prix in Vietnam this spring. Are any other events at risk?
Yeah, lots of events have already been cancelled in China. The highest profile one was the World Indoor Athletics Championships, which is due to take place in Nanjing in March. That's been cancelled. That will take place next year. That's what they hope. Anyway, there was a Formula E race that was cancelled as well. Badminton, tennis, golf, all of those sports have been affected by the coronavirus outbreak. And they've been cancelled in China. There's a football tournament was also cancelled. The Olympics is in Tokyo later this year. The organiser of the Olympics said a few weeks ago that he was extremely concerned about what might happen there if the coronavirus outbreak continued or got worse or spread. They are taking measures to counter that. The IOC privately hopes that this will all go away, it will all be done by May, and they will go ahead with the Olympics. But it is a concern. If there is a global pandemic, if it does spread, then that could affect the Olympics. That's what the organisers on the ground are worried about, but the measures are in place. They say they have a plan in place that they're affecting right now.
Alex Capstick, our sports news reporter. For more on the WHO meetings going on in Geneva, I spoke to our global health correspondent, Tulip Mazumdar.
There are around 400 scientists, some of the world's top scientists, meeting from around the world. Many of them have convened here. Some from China, for example, have joined online. And they're meeting here in Geneva to try and come up with a coordinated global plan of action to find out as much as they can about this COVID-19 disease. Almost 2 months into this outbreak, there are still many key questions that remain unanswered, such as how long are people infected for, how it's able to spread so effectively between people. It's still unclear what the mechanisms of that are. And also, where did this virus actually come from? Was it from an animal? If so, what animal was it? So those sorts of questions are being answered, as well as looking at how to fast track new vaccines and treatments. At the moment, there are no specific vaccines or treatments to deal with this virus. The World Health Organization's biggest concern at this stage is what would happen if we start seeing cases popping up in poorer countries with weaker health systems. So, you know, in many Western countries, in the UK, for example, cases are picked up very quickly. There is a system in place. They have the diagnostic tests. They have all the protective gear that health workers need to make sure that they can treat people in special infectious disease units safely. They don't have that in many poorer countries with weak health systems. So the concern, certainly from here, is that if this virus gets into those countries, and it may have already done that because these countries, many aren't set up to actually diagnose and look out for this virus, then that could cause, to put it in the words of the Director General of the World Health Organization, international havoc.
Chula Bazumdar in Geneva. In the past few months, the Roman Catholic Church has been grappling with the question of whether to allow married men to become priests. Bishops advising Pope Francis had backed the idea, particularly for the Amazon region, as a means of addressing the shortage of Catholic priests there. But the decision needed the Pope's approval to be implemented. Today, Pope Francis has ruled against it. The decision was included in an announcement to the media by the Vatican, as our Rome correspondent Mark Lowen told me.
After praying and reflecting, the Pope has decided not to foresee changes or exceptions on the issue of priestly celibacy. What they are referring to is the Pope's response to a synod of bishops held here in Rome last October, in which the majority voted in favour of relaxing the rules on priestly celibacy for the Amazon region to address the shortage of priests, as you laid out, to allow some married men to become priests. It is now the response of the Pope that will not happen, and also that he will not allow women to be appointed as deacons, which is a lower rank than a priest.
And of course, despite this decision, the Amazon will still have a shortage of priests. How great is that need?
It's a real problem for many there, some of whom go months without seeing a priest in very, very isolated areas. So the idea that some married men would be allowed into the priesthood was seen by supporters of it as a way of addressing the shortage. However, conservatives within the Catholic Church, Roman Catholic Church, had feared that it could have set a precedent for allowing the ordination of married men in other parts of the world. And there was a lot of pressure, particularly actually last month when Pope Francis's predecessor, Benedict XVI, co-authored a book defending priestly celibacy. That was seen as the kind of conservative wing of the church trying to stop the reform from happening. However, Pope Francis is said to have made a decision on this before that book was published. He has always spoken out in favour of priestly celibacy. And it seems that, you know, a 2,000-year-old church moves slowly, and that on this issue of priestly celibacy, which I have to say is not actually church doctrine, it is a tradition that came in the 12th century, for the moment, that is not going to change.
Mark Lowen, our Rome correspondent. The president of Turkey, Recep Tayyip Erdogan, has warned that his military will attack anywhere in Syria if Turkish troops currently in the north of the country come under fire again from Syrian government forces. Richard Galpin has more details.
President Erdogan's threat comes after recent skirmishes between the two sides killed both Turkish and Syrian troops in the northern province of Idlib, the last area of Syria still under rebel control. Turkey backs some of the rebel groups in the area and is alarmed by the recent major advances of Syrian forces into the province. The president claimed in his speech that Syrian forces were now being pushed back. A senior advisor to President Erdogan told the BBC they would teach the Syrians a lesson.
Richard Galpin. And Syrian government troops have captured a major road they lost in 2012. It's in Idlib province, the last bastion of opposition forces. Huge numbers of civilians are fleeing the fighting, but where will they find shelter? Our Middle East correspondent Quentin Somerville reports.
The roads of rebel-held Idlib are jammed by an exodus. the greatest in 9 years of Syria's war, almost 700,000 people on the move, fleeing the advance of Bashar al-Assad's regime. In the village of Joseph, the Fatrawi family is packing up. Al-Adin Fatrawi deserted from the Syrian army after the revolution began. Now he has no choice but to head north.
We are fleeing from our village towards the Turkish border because we are in fear for our children and women. We are heading towards the unknown, and we do not know what lies ahead.
His 7-year-old son, Hussein, struggles with the family carpet. He doesn't want to leave their home.
We're leaving our house because of the army. The army executes those who stay here.
Nearby, his 9-year-old brother, Mohammed, is helping to load the truck. He says he wants to become a fighter. He calls the regime forces infidels.
The soldiers of the army will slaughter us if they find us here. We will leave our home and flee to any area.
In the town of Kafr Nurin, they heard the warplanes coming, but their homes offered no protection. In the aftermath, amid the ambulances and the debris, Abu Ahmed lifts a grey blanket. Inside, a charred corpse.
I can't recognise him, my father or my brother, I don't know. We lift and bury. This is our fate as the Syrian people.
To the south, Turkish-backed rebels scored a small victory. They hit a regime helicopter as it made its way back to base. It bursts into flames, but still manages to fly. Then, all control is lost and it crashes into an olive grove. At the site, a man dressed in combat gear explains in Turkish, "The helicopter behind me belongs to the regime. It was dropping barrel bombs on Muslims, innocent civilians, women and children." But Turkish-backed forces and the extremist group Hayat Tahrir al-Sham are mostly losing these days. The regime today achieved a long-hoped-for goal, retaking the M5 road, a critical route between Damascus and Aleppo. In Idlib City Hospital, Ahmed Hawi, a 14-year-old boy, struggles to breathe. Ahmed is black with dirt. He's been dug out of the rubble after Syrian jets attacked a market in Idlib City. 17 people died around him. In a nearby bed, 11-year-old Reem Aboud screams in pain. The medics cut through her pink dress. She's been hit by shrapnel. Some 230 civilians have been killed in Idlib this year. Both Ahmed and Reem will survive, but without a ceasefire, what then? As the regime advances, they'll have no choice but to head north to the sprawling camps on the Turkish border. Corralled and forgotten, joining close to 1 million people who dared to challenge Bashar al-Assad.
That report was by Quentin Somerville. British scientists and Syrian refugees at a camp in Jordan are working together to create a way to grow fresh food using foam from old mattresses. The foam works in place of soil in a system called hydroponics. Our science correspondent Victoria Gill has this report from the Zaatari camp in Jordan.
The problem was there were 10,000 of them when I first arrived.
Wow, OK.
And I had to clamber up to get one down. But I was so excited because I knew what we could do with them.
A mountain of foam mattresses in a warehouse in Zaatari refugee camp sparked a bit of a green eureka moment for Professor Tony Ryan from the University of Sheffield. This huge pile of synthetic foam was, he realised, the way to provide everyone in the camp with a vegetable garden, using foam in place of soil.
Growing things in a tub with polyurethane foam, the foam just holds the plant upright. All the other functions of the soil come from the nutrients in the water, and the foam allows the roots to do their thing.
In this, the world's largest Syrian refugee camp, the desert soil is too poor to cultivate anything. But hundreds of people have now set up their own hydroponic gardens with recycled plastic tubs and old mattress foam. This method of growing nutritious food in such a challenging and crowded urban environment could be a model in cities around the world as they face feeding a growing population in a hotter, drier climate. But here in Zaatari, Maiar Al-Anani from the UN Refugee Agency says it's giving people back just a piece of a lost livelihood.
Having the old ladies so happy for having their homes green again and feeling so comfortable, teaching something new for the new generation to have their sustainability in the future in case anything bad happens.
Kids are learning hydroponics too. Yeah.
They do.
That report from Jordan was by Victoria Gill. And still to come in this edition of our podcast.
For me, it's more than about the emissions. It's more than about not flying. It's about a slowing down. And, you know, if I was to start a global movement, I think I'd call it the Great Slowing Down.
Why members of an Australian band decided not to accept some high-profile gigs in order to help fight climate change. As we record this podcast, a US spy satellite is being tailed by two Russian satellites. That's according to a US military commander. But the accusation and its repercussions are an echo of Cold War tactics. To find out more about what's been happening, I spoke to our correspondent in Moscow, Steve Rosenberg.
Well, we've grown used to East-West confrontation on this planet, haven't we? But this is an example of Cold War-style tension going cosmic, really. The commander of US Space Force, which is the Pentagon's brand new force recently unveiled by Donald Trump. The commander said publicly two Russian satellites have been tailing a US military satellite, so surveillance in space. And according to some reports, at one point, the Russian craft flew to 100 miles or so of the US satellite. That might not sound very much, but if you and I, Jonathan, were standing 100 miles or so apart, we probably wouldn't consider each other a threat. But in cosmic terms, 100 miles is pretty close. So Washington said this created the potential for a dangerous situation. The Russians have now responded. Moscow has confirmed that, yes, the US sent a note about this, raised the matter through diplomatic channels. But there's been no admission from the Russians and certainly no apology. And as so often when it gets accused of something by the West, Moscow's reaction could be summed up as, well, look who's talking. In other words, you know, Russia's pointed the finger back at America. Russia's deputy foreign minister criticised America and NATO for statements they have made in the past about making space an operational domain. And the deputy minister also claimed that Washington's plans and intentions in space were far more aggressive than Russia's. I suppose he would say that, wouldn't he? But certainly quite recently, President Trump did call the cosmos the world's newest war-fighting domain, and he did declare that American superiority in space was absolutely vital.
The US has a space force now as well. Does Russia have anything similar to this space force idea?
It's interesting because actually the word space is actually part of that phrase that Russia uses to describe its regular armed forces. Yes, there's no doubt that space is being looked at by the Russian military. So, you know, when Russia points the finger of blame at America and accuses NATO and America and France of treating space as an operational domain, well, they're doing exactly the same.
Steve Rosenberg speaking to me from Moscow. Back here on Earth, Bernie Sanders has overcome a crowded field to firmly establish himself as one of the Democrats' front-runners to be the party's candidate for US president. The self-styled Democratic Socialist narrowly won the New Hampshire primary, the latest vote in a series which decides who will contest the election with Donald Trump in November. It was a bruising night for some others, though, who must now decide how long to stay in the race. Nick Bryant sent this from New Hampshire.
He's a 78-year-old one-time socialist who had a heart attack in October.
Thank you, New Hampshire.
The victory is the lifeblood of a successful presidential campaign, and Bernie Sanders won last night in New Hampshire.
This victory here is the beginning of the end for Donald Trump.
It wasn't the thumping triumph of 4 years ago against Hillary Clinton, but it does make him the tribune of the Democratic left.
No matter who wins, and we certainly hope it's going to be us, we are going to unite together and defeat the most dangerous president in the modern history of this country.
Only 6 months ago, Pete Buttigieg would have been delighted at a close second place showing in New Hampshire. But after claiming victory in Iowa last week, he was hoping for another upset. Still, this gay former mayor can now lay claim to being the leading moderate in the race.
Americans want the freedom to make choices for themselves on health care or on any other issue, not to have Washington decide for them. And a politics of my way or the highway is a road to re-electing Donald Trump.
Thank you, New Hampshire.
The unexpected storyline of the night was written by the Minnesota Senator Amy Klobuchar, a Midwest moderate who came in a strong third.
I'm Amy Klobuchar, and I will beat Donald Trump.
Thrust into the national spotlight, it almost sounded as if she was launching her campaign.
Donald Trump's worst nightmare is that the people in the middle, the people who have had enough of the name calling and the mudslinging, have someone to vote for in November.
In this age of political disruption, rule books are being ripped up page by page.
Hello.
Joe Biden was already in South Carolina, the site of an upcoming primary where he hopes the votes of African Americans will throw him a lifeline.
We just heard from the first two of 50 states. Two of them. Not all the nation, not half the nation, not a quarter of the nation. Two.
But his journey south felt like a westward ride into the sunset.
Wall Street Peace! Wall Street Peace!
This was a moment of the night, supporters of Bernie Sanders turning on Pete Buttigieg when he appeared on the big screen. Wall Street Pete, they chanted, mocking his moderation.
Bernie beats Trump!
Democratic divisions are being laid bare. This looks like the start of a long and self-destructive fight. And the main beneficiary is the man they all want to beat, President Donald J. Trump.
That report was by Nick Bryant. During Sunday night's Academy Awards, the Oscar for Best Animated Short Film went to Hair Love, which is about an African-American father attempting to style his daughter's natural hair for the first time. Hair Love has raised conversations about the importance of hair and heritage in the black community. It also echoed the story of a teenager from Texas whose school administrators told him he wouldn't be able to graduate if he didn't cut his dreadlocks. Well, here in the UK, a pupil who was repeatedly sent home from school in London because of the size of her afro hairdo has received an out-of-court payment after her family took legal action. Ruby Williams was told by the Urswick School that her hair breached school policy, which stated that afro-style hair must be of reasonable size and length. She received nearly $11,000, but the school did not admit any liability. Claire McDonald spoke to Ruby and her dad, Lenny.
I'd gone in with my hair out in the way that it naturally is as an afro, which I had been doing when I was in year 9 and when I was in year 8. But all of a sudden, it was the second week of year 10, and when I went in, I was approached and told, oh, your hair's a bit big today, like, you need to change that. So at first, I did think it was a joke. I thought maybe the person was just being a bit insensitive and they didn't realise it might be offensive. So I kind of laughed it off and thought, oh, they must be just joking. Maybe they were trying to do a compliment, but they thought that, oh, that your hair's a bit big today, was maybe they thought that was, like, funny. And then the next day, I went in with my hair out again and was told, oh, you didn't listen, you need to change it. Like, you will be sent home if you don't change your hair because it breaches the uniform policy.
And when their policy stated hair has to be a reasonable size and length, can you kind of paint a picture for us of how out your hair was on those 2 days?
When I was in year 9, it was actually bigger than it was in year 10. I'd cut my hair over the summer, which is why I wasn't really tying it back, because I would have to blow dry it just to tie it back in a way that I would like it to look. Otherwise, it would just be really small and I'd have to use a lot of gel to get it into a slicked style the way that they would have wanted me to do it.
And when you put these arguments to them, what were you told?
I was told that it wasn't discrimination, that there were people who had afros who didn't actually have afro-textured hair, that any type of curly hair was seen as afro hair, and that it wasn't discrimination because anybody who had hair with as much volume as mine would be sent home for the same reason. So they saw it as it wasn't something against me. But the way I saw it was that I was having my hair out, and if somebody who had straight hair had their hair out, it was fine for them. So they could wake up in the morning and leave their hair the way that it naturally is, and it would be fine.
Lenny, what did you think when Ruby came home with this news that, you know, that the hair was unacceptable in the way it was being worn?
Angry, yeah. You know, I said, you send your daughter to school and you just want them to go to school to take an education.
This was a crucial time for you, wasn't it? Because you were taking your end of school exams, your GCSEs. What kind of effect did this ongoing row have on you?
Well, it meant that I had issues with going into school. Sometimes in the morning I'd wake up and think, I don't want to go into school today because I have to do this. And if my hair wasn't cooperating the way that I would want it to, if it can't tie up, then what am I supposed to do? Because if I go in, I'm going to be humiliated when I walk in and sent home straight away.
Lenny, you have this victory now. You received £8,500 in an out-of-court settlement after legal action against the school. What do you think this says about the situation you found yourselves in?
A lot of people say victory. I don't know about victory as such, because the whole idea why we took this matter further was to change that rule to accommodate not just for my daughter, but for every child of ethnicity who's got hair like Ruby.
Ruby Williams and her father Lenny speaking to Claire McDonnell. One of the commonest types of penguin in the Antarctic has dramatically declined in numbers, according to a new survey. Noah Stricker, an ornithologist from New York Stony Brook University, has been taking part in the study, and he told Dan Damon about the chinstrap penguin and what seems to be happening to it.
Chinstrap penguins are about the size and shape of a bowling pin, but they look like they're wearing a little tuxedo, black and white. They live mostly around the Antarctic Peninsula, so on sub-Antarctic islands and in Antarctica, south of South America.
And there are far fewer of them now. How fewer?
We just finished a 44-day expedition to a couple of very remote islands in this area, the core of the Chinstraps range, that have not been surveyed in about 50 years. And when we compared our survey this time versus how many there were in 1971, we found more than a 50% decline in the Chinstraps population.
Might they have gone somewhere else?
We know that young chinstraps come back to the same colony that they hatched in when they were a chick from tagging studies. So it's very unlikely that these penguins have simply moved. It's probably that the population has declined from increased mortality and reduced survival over those 50 years.
And how are you explaining that?
We know that climate change has hit the Antarctic Peninsula particularly hard in the last several decades. We can see from climate data that things have warmed up here more than almost anywhere else in the Southern Hemisphere, including other parts of Antarctica. So things are changing. There's less sea ice than there used to be. That probably affects the population of krill, which is chinstrap penguins' favorite food. So climate change, we think, is affecting the base of the food web here, and then that is rippling on up and affecting penguin populations.
Right, so it's about the food supply, basically. The food supply has diminished because the climate has changed.
Everything in Antarctica in the summertime eats krill. All the whales, all the seals, all the penguins, pretty much. And so if anything starts affecting that food supply, yeah, it's going to cause pretty big changes.
Noah Stricker of New York Stony Brook University speaking to Dan Damon. And finally,
I want to see myself as a part of the whole. Grow some food for my family food bowl. Stand my ground but give up control. Know the boundaries but tear down all the walls.
That's the Australian electro-funk band Formidable Vegetable with their song Earth People Fair. Sustainable living has become a major talking point across the globe as people try to work out how to change their behaviour to help fight climate change. And Formidable Vegetable recently turned down the chance to play some huge gigs, including the Glastonbury Festival here in the UK and one at the Sydney Opera House, because they don't want to fly. Charlie McGee is Formidable Vegetable's frontman.
Last year, my band said no to Glastonbury as a result of just not wanting to fly anymore. And I'd been hearing about the ramifications of climate change and, you know, had just read the IPCC 1.5 degree report, which said that we pretty much have the next decade to sort out climate change or face dire consequences. And I thought, you know, enough's enough, so I'm not going to fly anymore. And yeah, that's had a few consequences for the band. We have played Glastonbury before, and it was incredible for our careers, but this time when I said no, I expected they'd be a little bit annoyed and maybe never want to hear from us again, but they were surprisingly supportive, and they said they understood where we were coming from, and you know, if we ever found an alternative means to come to the UK, they'd give us a gig. But for me, it's more than about the emissions. It's more than about not flying. It's about a slowing down. And, you know, if I was to start a global movement, I think I'd call it the Great Slowing Down, because, you know, a lot of what we sing about is my band's a little bit unique in that we sing almost exclusively about permaculture. Permaculture comes from the words permanent culture. And I suppose nowadays it's a lot of it's referred to as regenerative culture, whereby we're trying to find ways to work with nature rather than against it. And I think it's become a lot more obvious that we need to do that in light of the recent bushfires in Australia and the flooding and all of the global catastrophes that are coming to a head as a result of climate change. I'm starting to go down the road of educational gigs and school shows because I really feel for the children who are taking on this burden of climate change and this world that we're moving into. And we've got a bit of a school show tour booked around Australia in our waste vegetable oil powered fire truck touring rig. So that's the plan for this year.
Charlie McGee of the band Formidable Vegetable. And that's all from us for now, but there will be an updated version of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on this edition or the topics we covered in it, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. I'm Jonathan Savage, and until next time, goodbye.